an initial desire to better adjust the affairs of mankind, which ended as is quite usual in the more liberal adjustment of his own fortunes. It is related how Captain Mission, having led his ship to victory against an English man of war, called a meeting of the crew. Those who wished to follow him he would welcome and treat as brothers, those who did not would be safely put ashore. One and all embraced the new freedom. Some were for hoisting the black flag at once, but Mission demurred, saying that they were not pirates but liberty lovers, fighting for equal rights against all nations subject to the tyranny of government, and bespoke a white flag as the more fitting emblem. The ship's money was put in a chest to be used as common property. Clothes were now distributed to all in need, and the Republic of the Sea was in full operation. Mission bespoke them to live in strict harmony among themselves, that a misplaced society would adjudge them still as pirates. Self-preservation, therefore, and a cruel disposition, compelled them to declare war on all nations who should close their ports to them. I declare such war, and at the same time recommend to you a humane and generous behavior towards your prisoners, which will appear by so much more the effects of a noble soul, and as we are satisfied we should not meet the same treatment should our ill fortune or want of courage give us up to their mercy. The Nieuwstad of Amsterdam was made prize, giving up £2,000 and gold dust and 17 slaves. The slaves were added to the crew and clothed in the Dutchman's spare garments. Mission made an address denouncing slavery, holding that men who sold others like beasts proved their religion to be no more than a grimace, as no man had power of liberty over another. Mission explored the Madagascar coast and found a bay 10 leagues north of Diego Sarez. It was resolved to establish here the shore quarters of the Republic, erect a town, build docks, and have a place they might call their own. The colony was called Libertadia and was placed under articles drawn up by Captain Mission. The articles state, among other things, all decisions with regard to the colony to be submitted to vote by the colonists, the abolition of the death penalty, and freedom to follow any religious beliefs or practices without sanction or molestation. Captain Mission's colony, which numbered about 300, was wiped out by a surprise attack from the natives, and Captain Mission was killed shortly afterwards in a sea battle. There were other such colonies in the West Indies and in Central and South America, but they were not able to maintain themselves since they were not sufficiently populous to withstand attack. Had they been able to do so, the history of the world could have been altered. Imagine a number of such fortified positions all through South America and the West Indies, stretching from Africa to Madagascar and the East Indies, all offering refuge to fugitives from slavery and oppression. Come to us and live under the articles. At once we have allies in all those who are enslaved and oppressed throughout the world, from the cotton plantations of the American South to the sugar plantations of the West Indies, and the whole Indian population of the American continent peonized and degraded by the Spanish into subhuman poverty and ignorance, exterminated by the Americans, infected with their vices and diseases, the natives of Africa and Asia, all these are potential allies. Fortified positions supported by and supporting guerrilla hit and run bands, supplied with soldiers, weapons, medicines, and information by the local populations, such a combination would be unbeatable. If the whole American army couldn't beat the Viet Cong at a time when fortified positions were rendered obsolete by artillery and air strikes, certainly the armies of Europe, operating in unfamiliar territory and susceptible to all the disabling diseases of tropical countries, could not have beaten guerrilla tactics plus fortified positions. Consider the difficulties which such an invading army would face: continual harassment from the guerrillas, a totally hostile population always ready with poison, misdirection, snakes, and spiders in the general's bed, armadillos carrying the deadly earth-eating disease rooting under the barracks and adopted as mascots by the regiment as dysentery and malaria take their toll. The sieges could not but present a series of military disasters. There is no stopping the articulated. The white man is retroactively relieved of his burden. Whites will be welcomed as workers, settlers, teachers, and technicians, but not as colonists or masters. No man may violate the articles. Imagine such a movement on a worldwide scale. Faced by the actual practice of freedom, the French and American revolutions would be forced to stand by their words. the disastrous results of uncontrolled industrialization would also be curtailed, since factory workers and slum dwellers from the cities would seek refuge in articulated areas. Any man would have the right to settle in any area of his choosing. The land would belong to those who used it. No white man boss, no Pukka Sahib, no patrons, no colonists. The escalation of mass production and concentration of population in urban areas would be halted, for who would work in their factories and buy their products when he could live from the fields and the sea and the lakes and the rivers in areas of unbelievable plenty? And living from the land, he would be motivated to preserve its resources. I cite this example of retroactive utopia since it actually could have happened in terms of the techniques and human resources available at the time. Had Captain Mission lived long enough to set an example for others to follow, mankind might have stepped free from the deadly impasse of insoluble problems in which we now find ourselves. The chance was there. The chance was missed. The principles of the French and American revolutions became windy lies in the mouths of politicians. The liberal revolutions of 1848 created the so-called republics of Central and South America, with a dreary history of dictatorship, oppression, graft, and bureaucracy, thus closing this vast, underpopulated continent to any possibility of communes along the lines set forth by Captain Mission. In any case, South America will soon be crisscrossed by highways and motels. In England, Western Europe, and America, the overpopulation made possible by the Industrial Revolution leaves scant room for communes, which are commonly subject to state and federal law and frequently harassed by the local inhabitants. There is simply no room left for freedom from the tyranny of government since city dwellers depend on it for food, power, water, transportation, protection, and welfare. Your right to live where you want, with companions of your choosing, under laws to which you agree, died in the 18th century with Captain Mission. Only a miracle or a disaster could restore it. Invocation. This book is dedicated to the Ancient Ones, to the Lord of Abominations, Humwurwa, whose face is a mass of entrails, whose breath is the stench of dung and the perfume of death, dark angel of all that is excreted and sours, Lord of Decay, Lord of the Future, who rides on a whispering south wind, to Pazuzu, Lord of Fevers and Plagues, dark angel of the four winds with rotting genitals from which he howls through sharpened teeth over stricken cities, to Kuchalu, the sleeping serpent who cannot be summoned, to the Akharu, who suck the blood of men since they desire to become men, to the Laasu, who haunt the places of men, to Galal and Lilith, who invade the beds of men and whose children are born in secret places, to Adu, raiser of storms who can fill the night sky with brightness, to Mala, lord of courage and bravery, to Zagarim, whose number is 23 and who kills in an unnatural fashion, to Zarim, a warrior among warriors, to Itzamna, spirit of early mists and showers. To Nine Chel, the spider web that catches the dew of morning, to Zuwikak, virgin fire, to Ajiz, the master of cold, to Kaku Pocket, who works in fire, to Nine Tab, goddess of ropes and snares, patroness of those who hang themselves, to Shmuun, the silent one, twin brother of Nine Tab, to Kolital the unformed, lord of rebirth, to Aguchi, master of ejaculations, to Osiris and Amen in phallic form, to Hex Chun Chan, the dangerous one, to Apuk, the destroyer, to the great old one and the star beast, to Pen, god of panic, to the nameless gods of dispersal and emptiness, to Hassan Isabah, master of assassins, to all the scribes and artists and practitioners of magic through whom these spirits have been manifested. Nothing is true. Everything is permitted. Book 1. The Health Officer. September 13, 1923. Farnsworth, the district health officer, was a man so grudging in what he asked of life that every win was a loss, yet he was not without a certain plodding persistence of effort and effectiveness in his limited area. The current emergency posed by the floods and the attendant cholera epidemic, while it did not spur him to any unusual activity, left him unruffled. Every morning at sunrise, He bundled his greasy maps which he studied at breakfast while he licked butter off his fingers into his battered Land Rover and set out to inspect his district, stopping here and there to order more sandbags for the levees, knowing his orders would be disregarded, as they generally were unless the commissioner happened to be with him. He ordered three bystanders, presumably relatives, to transport a cholera case to the district hospital at Wakdas and left three opium pills and instructions for preparing rice water. They nodded, and he drove on, having done what he could. The emergency hospital at Wakdas was installed in an empty army barracks left over from the war. It was understaffed and overcrowded, mostly by patients who lived near enough and were still strong enough to walk. The treatment for cholera was simple. Each patient was assigned to a straw pallet on arrival and given a gallon of rice water and half a gram of opium. If he was still alive 12 hours later, the dose of opium was repeated. The survival rate was about 20%. Pallets of the dead were washed in carbolic solution and left in the sun to dry. The attendants were mostly Chinese who had taken the job because they were allowed to smoke opium and feed the ash to the patients. The smell of cooking rice, opium smoke, excrement and carbolic permeated the hospital and the area around it for several hundred yards. At 10 o'clock the health officer entered the hospital. He requisitioned more carbolic and opium, and sent off another request for a doctor, which he expected and hoped would be ignored. He felt that a doctor fussing around the hospital would only make matters worse. He might even object to the opium dosage as too high, or attempt to interfere with the opium smoking of the attendants. The health officer had very little use for doctors. They simply complicated things to make themselves important. After spending half an hour in the hospital, he drove to Gaddi's to see the commissioner, who invited him to lunch. He accepted without enthusiasm, declining a gin before lunch and a beer with lunch. He picked at the rice and fish, and ate a small plate of stewed fruit. He was trying to persuade the commissioner to assign some convicts to work on the levees. "Sorry, old boy, not enough soldiers to guard them." "Well, it's a serious situation." "Dare say." Farnsworth did not press the point. He simply did what he could and let it go at that. Newcomers to the district wondered what kept him going at all. Old-timers like the commissioner knew. For the health officer had a sustaining vice. Every morning at sunrise, he brewed a pot of strong tea and washed down a gram of opium. When he returned from his rounds in the evening, he repeated the dose and gave it time to take effect before he prepared his evening meal of stewed fruit and wheat bread. He had no permanent house boy, since he feared a boy might steal his opium. Twice a week he had a boy in to clean the bungalow, and then he locked his opium up in an old rusty safe where he kept his reports. He had been taking opium for 5 years and had stabilized his dosage after the first year and never increased it, nor gone on to injections of morphine. This was not due to strength of character, but simply to the fact that he felt he owed himself very little, and that was what he allotted himself. Driving back to find the sandbags not there, the cholera patient dead, and his three relatives droopy-eyed from the opium pills he had left, he felt neither anger nor exasperation, only the slight lack that had increased in the last hour of his drive, so that he stepped harder on the accelerator. Arriving at his bungalow, he washed down an opium pill with bottled water and lit the kerosene stove for his tea. He carried the tea onto the porch and by the time he had finished the second cup, he was feeling the opium wash through the back of his neck and down his withered thighs. He could have passed for 50, actually he was 28. He sat there for half an hour looking at the muddy river and the low hills covered with scrub. There was a mutter of thunder, and as he cooked his evening meal the first drops of rain fell on the rusty galvanized iron roof. He awoke to the unaccustomed sound of lapping water. Hastily he pulled on his pants and stepped onto the porch. Rain was still falling, and the water had risen during the night to a level of 12 inches under the bungalow and a few inches below the hubcaps of his Land Rover. He washed down an opium pill and put water on the stove for his tea. Then he dusted off an alligator skin Gladstone bag and started packing, opening drawers and compartments in the safe. He packed clothes, reports, a compass, a sheath knife, a 45 Webley revolver and a box of shells, matches, and a mess kit. He filled his canteen with bottled water and wrapped a loaf of bread in paper. Pouring his tea, the water rising under his feet, he experienced a tension in the groin, a surge of adolescent lust that was stronger for being inexplicable and inappropriate. His medical supplies and opium he packed in a separate bag, and as an added precaution, a slab of opium the size of a cigarette package, wrapped in heavy tinfoil, went into his side coat pocket. By the time he had finished packing, his pants were sticking out at the fly. The opium would soon take care of that. He stepped from the porch into the Land Rover. The motor caught, and he headed for high ground above the flood. The route he took was seldom used, and several times he had to cut trees out of the road with an axe. Towards sundown, he reached the medical mission of Father Dupre. This was out of his district, and he had met the priest only once before. Father Dupre, a thin red-faced man with a halo of white hair, greeted him politely but without enthusiasm. He brightened somewhat when Farnsworth brought out his supplies and went with him to the dispensary and hospital, which was simply a large hut screened in at the sides. The health officer passed out opium pills to all the patients. No matter what is wrong with them, they will feel better shortly. The priest nodded absently as he led the way back to the house. Farnsworth had swallowed his opium pill with water from his canteen, and it was beginning to take effect as he sat down on the porch. The priest was looking at him with a hostility he was trying hard to conceal. Farnsworth wondered what exactly was wrong. The priest fidgeted and cleared his throat. He said abruptly in a strained voice, "Would you care for a drink?" "Thank you, no. I never touch it." Relief flooded the priest's face with a beneficent glow. "Something else then. I'd love some tea." "Of course. I'll have the boy make it." The priest came back with a bottle of whiskey, a glass, and a soda siphon. Farnsworth surmised that he kept his whiskey under lock and key somewhere out of the reach of his boys. The priest poured himself a generous four fingers and shot in a dash of soda. He took a long drink and beamed at his guest. Farnsworth decided that the moment was propitious to ask a favor, while the good father was still relieved at not having to share his dwindling supply of whiskey, and before he had overindulged. "I want to get through to Gaddy's if possible. I suppose it's hopeless by road, even if I had enough petrol." The priest got a map and spread it out on the table. "Absolutely out of the question. This whole area is flooded. Only possibility is by boat to here, from there it's 40 miles downriver to Gaddy's. I could lend you a boat with a boy and outboard, but there's no petrol here. I think I have enough petrol for that, considering it's all downstream. You'll run into log jams, may take hours to cut through, figure how long it could take you at the longest, and then double it. My boy knows the route as far as here. Now this stretch here is very dangerous, the river narrows quite suddenly, no noise you understand, and no warning. Advise you to take the canoe out and carry it down to here, take one extra day, but well worth it at this time of year. Of course you might get through, but if anything goes wrong, the current, you understand. Even a strong swimmer." The following day at dawn, Farnsworth's belongings and the supplies for the trip were loaded into the dugout canoe. The boy, Ali, was a smoky black with sharp features, clearly a mixture of Arab and Negro stock. He was about 18, with beautiful teeth and a quick shy smile. The priest waved from the jetty as the boat swung into midstream. Farnsworth sat back lazily, watching the water and the jungle slide past. There was not much sign of life. A few birds and monkeys. Once three alligators wallowing in a mud bank slid into the water, showing their teeth in depraved smiles. Several times log jams had to be cleared with an axe. At sundown they made camp on a gravel bank. Farnsworth put water on for tea while Ali walked to the end of the band and dropped a hook baited with a worm into a deep clear pool. By the time the water was boiling, he was back with an 18-inch fish. As Ali cleaned the fish and cut it into sections, Farnsworth washed down his opium pill. He offered one to Ali, who examined it, sniffed at it, smiled, and shook his head. Chinese boy. He leaned over holding an imaginary opium pipe to a lamp. He drew the smoke in and let his eyes droop. No get, he put his hands on his stomach and rocked back and forth. By the afternoon of the second day the stream had widened considerably. Towards sundown Farnsworth took an opium pill and dozed off. Suddenly he was wide awake with a start, and he reached for the map. This was the stretch that Father Dupre had warned him about. He turned towards Ali, but Ali knew already. He was steering for shore. The silent rush of the current swept the boat broadside, and the rudder wire snapped like a bowstring. The boat twisted out of control, swept towards a logjam. A splintering crash, and Farnsworth was underwater, struggling desperately against the current. He felt a stab of pain as a branch ripped through his coat and along his side. He came to on the bank. Ali was pushing water out of his lungs. He sat up breathing heavily and coughing. His coat was in tatters, oozing blood. He felt for his pocket, and looked at his empty hand. The opium was gone. He had sustained a superficial scratch down the left hip and across the buttock. They had salvaged nothing except the short machete that Ali wore in a sheath at his belt, and Farnsworth's hunting knife. Farnsworth drew a map in the sand to approximate their positing. He calculated the distance to one of the large tributaries to be about 40 miles. Once there, they could fashion a raft and drift downstream to Gaddis, where, of course, the words of Father Dupre played back in his mind, "Figure the longest time it could take you and then double it." Darkness was falling, and they had to stay there for the night, even though he was losing precious travel time. He knew that in 72 hours at the outside he would be immobilized for lack of opium. At daybreak they set out heading north. Progress was slow, the undergrowth had to be cut step by step. There were swamps and streams in the way, and from time to time deep gorges that necessitated long detours. The unaccustomed exertion knocked the opium out of his system, and by nightfall he was already feverish and shivering. By morning he was barely able to walk, but managed to stagger along for a few miles. The next day he was convulsed by stomach cramps and they barely covered a mile. The third day he could not move. Ali massaged his legs, which were knotted with cramps, and brought him water and fruit. He lay there unable to move for 4 days and four nights. Occasionally he dozed off and woke up screaming from nightmares. These often took the form of attacks by centipedes and scorpions of strange sizes and shapes, moving with great speed, that would suddenly rush at him. Another recurrent nightmare was set in the market of a Near Eastern city. The place was at first unknown to him but more familiar with each step he took, as if some hideous jigsaw of memory were slowly falling into place, the stalls all empty of food and merchandise, the smell of hunger and death, the greenish glow and a strange smoky sun, sulphurous blazing hate in faces that turned to look at him as he passed. Now they were all pointing at him and shouting a word he could not understand. On the eighth day he was able to walk again. He was still racked with stomach cramps and diarrhea, but the leg cramps were almost gone. On the tenth day he felt distinctly better and stronger, and was able to eat a fish. On the 14th day they reached a sand bank by a wide clear river. This was not the tributary they were looking for, but would certainly lead into it. Ali had saved a piece of carbolic soap in a tin box, and they stripped off their tattered clothes and waded into the cool water. Farnsworth washed off the dirt and sweat and smell of his sickness. Ali was rubbing soap on his back and Farnsworth felt a sudden rush of blood to the crotch. Trying to hide his erection, he waded ashore with his back to Ali, who followed laughing and splashing water to wash the soap off. Farnsworth lay down on his shirt and pants and fell into a wordless vacuum, feeling the sun on his back and the faint ache of the healing scratch. He saw Ali sitting naked above him, Ali's hands massaging his back, moving down to the buttocks. Something was surfacing in his body, drifting up from remote depths of memory, and he saw as if projected on a screen a strange incident from his adolescence. He was in the British Museum at the age of 14, standing in front of a glass case. He was alone in the room. In the case was the figure, about 2 feet long, of a reclining man. The man was naked, the right knee flexed, holding the body a few inches off the ground, the penis exposed. The hands were extended in front of the man palms down, and the face was reptile or animal, something between an alligator and a jaguar. The boy was looking at the thighs and buttocks and genitals, breathing through his teeth. He was getting stiff and lubricating, his pants sticking out at the fly. He was squeezing into the figure, a dream tension gathering in his crotch, squeezing and stretching, a strange smell unlike anything he had ever smelled before but familiar as smell itself, a naked man lying by a wide clear river, the twisted figure. Silver spots boiled in front of his eyes and he ejaculated. Ali's hands parted his buttocks, he spit on his rectum, his body opening and the figure entering him in a silent rush, flexing his right knee, stretching his jaw forward into a snout, his head flattening, his brain squeezing out the smell from inside. A hoarse hissing sound was forced from his lips and light popped in his eyes as his body boiled and twisted out scalding spurts. Stage with a jungle backdrop. Frogs croak and birds call from recorder. Farnsworth as an adolescent is lying face down on sand. Ali is fucking him and he squirms with a slow wallowing movement, showing his teeth in a depraved smile. The lights dim for a few seconds. When the lights come up, Farnsworth is wearing an alligator suit that leaves his ass bare and Ali is still fucking him. As Ali and Farnsworth slide off stage, Farnsworth lifts one webbed finger to the audience while a marine band plays Semper Fi. Off stage splash. We see Tibet with the binoculars of the people. The scouting party stopped a few hundred yards from the village on the bank of a stream. Yen Li studied the village through his field glasses while his men sat down and lit cigarettes. The village was built into the side of a mountain. The stream ran through the town, and water had been diverted into pools on a series of cultivated terraces that led up to the monastery. There was no sign of life in the steep winding street or by the pools. The valley was littered with large boulders which would serve as cover if necessary, but he did not expect resistance on a military level. He lowered his glasses, signaling for the men to follow. They crossed a stone bridge two at a time, covered by the men behind them. If any defenders were going to open fire, now would be the time and place to do it. Beyond the bridge, the street twisted up the mountainside. On both sides there were stone huts, many of them fallen into ruin and obviously deserted. As they moved up the stone street, keeping to the sides and taking cover behind the ruined huts, Yen Li became increasingly aware of a hideous unknown odor. He motioned the patrol to halt and stood there sniffing. Unlike his counterparts in Western countries, he had been carefully selected for a high level of intuitive adjustment, and trained accordingly to imagine and explore seemingly fantastic potentials in any situation, while at the same time giving equal consideration to prosaic and practical aspects. He had developed an attitude at once probing and impersonal, remote and alert. He did not know when the training had begun, since in Academy 23 it was carried out in a context of reality. He did not see his teachers, whose instructions were conveyed through a series of real situations. He had been born in Hong Kong and had lived there until the age of 12, so that English was a second language. Then his family had moved to Shanghai. In his early teens he had read the American beat writers. The volumes had been brought through Hong Kong and sold under the counter in a bookshop that seemed to enjoy freedom from official interference, although the proprietor was also engaged in currency deals. At the age of 16 he was sent to a military academy, where he received intensive training in the use of weapons. After 6 months he was summoned to the colonel's office and told that he would be leaving the military school and returning to Shanghai. Since he had applied himself to the training and made an excellent showing, he asked the colonel if this was because his work had not been satisfactory. The colonel was looking not at him but around him, as if drawing a figure in the air. He indicated obliquely that while a desire to please one's superiors was laudable, other considerations were in certain cases even more highly emphasized. The smell hit him like an invisible wall. He stopped and leaned against a house. It was like rotten metal or metal excrement, he decided. The patrol was still in the ruined outskirts of the village. One man was vomiting violently, his face beaded with sweat. He straightened up and started towards the stream. Yan Li stopped him. "Don't drink the water or splash it on your face. The stream runs through the town." Yan Li sat down and looked once again at the town through his field glasses. There were still no villagers in sight. He put his glasses down and conducted an out-of-body exploration of the village, what Westerners call astral travel. He was moving up the street now, his gun at the ready. The gun would shoot blasts of energy, and he could feel it tingle in his hands. He kicked open a door. One glance told him that interrogation was useless. He would get no information on a verbal level. A man and a woman were in the terminal stages of some disease, their faces eaten to the bone by phosphorescent sores. An older woman was dead. The next hut contained five corpses, all elderly. In another hut a youth lay on a pallet, the lower half of his body covered by a blanket. Bright red nipples of flesh about an inch in height, growing in clusters, covered his chest and stomach and sprouted from his face and neck. The growths looked like exotic plants. He noticed that they were oozing a pearly juice that ate into the flesh, leaving luminescent sores. Sensing Yan Li's presence, the youth turned towards him with a slow idiot smile, arching his body and caressing the flesh clusters with one hand while the other hand slid under the blanket and moved to his crotch. In another hut, Yan Li glimpsed a scene that he quickly erased from memory. Yan Li advanced towards the monastery. Then he stopped. The gun went heavy and solid in his hands as energy left it. His training had not quite prepared him for the feeling of death that fell in a steady silent rain from the monastery above him. The monastery must contain a deadly force, probably some form of radioactivity, perhaps psychic fission. He surmised further that the illness afflicting the villagers was a radioactive virus strain. He knew that top secret research in the West was moving in this direction. As early as World War II, England had developed a radioactive virus known as the Doomsday Bug. Returning to his body, Yan Li weighed his observations and surmises. What had he glimpsed and hastily looked away from? Tiny creatures like translucent shrimp feeding at the flesh nipples, and something else. He did not push himself, knowing that a biologic protective reaction was shielding him from knowledge he was unable to assimilate and handle. The monastery probably contained a laboratory and the village had been used as a testing ground. How did the technicians protect themselves from the radiation? Could the laboratory be operated by remote control? Or had the technicians been immunized by gradient exposure? Did the laboratory contain a sophisticated door installation? He picked up a walkie-talkie. Pre-talk calling deadline. Well. The colonel's voice was cool, edged with abstract impatience. Cadets were expected to use their own initiative on patrol and only call in the case of emergency. Yan Li recounted what he had seen in the village and described the feeling of death that emanated from the monastery. It's like a wall. I can't get through it. Certainly my men can't. Withdraw from the village and make camp. A sanitary squad and a health officer are on the way. The doctor is on the market. Dr. Pearson was a discreet addict who kept himself down to 3 shots a day, half a grain in each shot. He could always cover for that. Towards the end of an 8-hour shift he tended to be perfunctory, so when he got the call from emergency he hoped it wouldn't take long or keep him overtime. Of course he could always slip a half grain under his tongue, but that was wasteful and he liked to be in bed when he took his shot, and feel it hit the back of his neck and move down the backs of his thighs while he blew cigarette smoke towards the ceiling. As he reached for his bag he noticed that he had barked his knuckles. He couldn't remember where or when that happens, when you are feeling no pain. It looks like measles, doctor. The doctor looked at the boy's face with distaste. He disliked children, adolescents, and animals. The word cute did not exist in his emotional vocabulary. There were red blotches on the boy's face but they seemed rather large for measles. Well, get it in here, nurse, whatever it is, away from the other patients. Not that I care what they catch, it's just hospital procedure. The boy was wheeled into a cubicle. His finger cold with reluctance, the doctor folded the sheet down to the boy's waist and noticed that he was wearing no shorts. "Why is he naked?" he snapped at the attendants. "He was like that when they picked him up, doctor." "Well, they might have put something on him." He turned back to the attendants. "What are you standing there for? Get out. And you, nurse, what are you gawking at? Order a bed in isolation." His temper was always evil when he ran over like this, but right after a shot he could be nice in a dead, fishy way. The doctor turned back to the boy on the bed. His duty as a physician was clear. Hippocrates pointing sternly to the sheet. "Well, I suppose I have to look at the little naked beast." He folded the sheet down to the boy's knees. The boy had an erection. The genitals and areas adjacent were bright red like a red bikini. The doctor leaped back as he would from a striking snake, but he was too late. A gob of semen hit the back of his hand right on the skinned knuckles. He wiped it off with an exclamation of disgust. He recalled later that he felt a slight tingling sensation which he didn't notice at the time, being that disgusted with the human body he wondered why he had chosen the medical profession. And this dirty child was delaying his fix. "You filthy little beast!" he snapped. The boy sniggered. The doctor pulled the sheet up to the boy's chin. He was washing his hands when the nurse came in with a stretcher table and an orderly to take the boy to isolation. The doctor sniffed. "My God, what's that smell? I don't know what this is, nurse, but it's rather disgusting. He seems to be in some state of sexual delirium. He also seems to be giving off a horrible odor. Order the broad spectrum, cortisone. Of course it may be an allergic condition red-haired animals are especially liable to and the usual antibiotics. If the sexual condition continues, do not hesitate to administer morphine." The doctor gasped and clasped a handkerchief in front of his mouth and nose. "Get it out of here." He always referred to a patient as the disease. "Do you have a typhoid bed in isolation?" he asked. "Not now, we don't." "Well, it can't stay here." He had barely settled in bed after his fix when the phone rang. It was the super. "Seems we have an epidemic on our hands, Pearson. All staff report back to the hospital immediately." Could it be that dirty little boy? He thought as he dressed and picked up his satchel and walked to the hospital. He saw there was a police line around the entrance. "Oh, yes, doctor, right over there for your mask. I'll help you put it on, doctor." A brisk young girl in some sort of uniform rubbed her tits against him in a most offensive manner. And before she got the mask on, he smelled it and he knew, it was that dirty little boy. Inside was a scene from Dante, stretchers side by side in the corridors, sperm all over the sheets, the walls, and the floor. "Be careful, doctor." A garrulous old nurse caught his arm in time. "Just put one foot solidly in front of the other, doctor, that's right, it's terrible, doctor, the older patients are dying like flies. I don't want to hear any generalities, nurse, take me to my ward." "Well, doctor, you can take the northeast wing if you want right here." Every sort of copulation was going on in front of him, every disgusting thing they could think of. Some of them had pillowcases and towels wrapped around each other's necks in some kind of awful contest. As these crazed patients seemed in danger of strangulation, and here the doctor almost slipped in shit, he ordered attendants to restrain them, but no attendants were available. "We'll start with morphine and a curare derivative, nurse." "Sorry, doctor, the morphine stocks are exhausted on the older patients. They go into the most awful spasms at the end, doctor." The doctor turned pale as death at this terrible pronouncement. He slumped to the floor in a faint, his face covered with red blotches. By the time they got his clothes off, his body was also affected, and spontaneous orgasms were observed. Dr. Pearson subsequently recovered, because of his addiction, and went to work for the pickle factory on a sensitive biological project. Politics here is death. Muted remote boardroom. Dr. Pearson sits at the head of the table with notes in front of him. He speaks in a dry, flat academic voice. Ladies and gentlemen of the board, I am here to give a report on preliminary experiments with virus B23. Consider the origins of this virus in the cities of the Red Night. The red glow that covered the northern sky at night was a form of radiation that gave rise to a plague known to be the etiological agent. Virus B23 has been called, among other things, the virus of biological mutation, since this agent occasioned biologic alterations in those affected, fatal in many cases, permanent and hereditary in the survivors, who became carriers of the strain. The original inhabitants of these cities were black, but soon a wide spectrum of albino variations appeared, and this condition was passed on to their descendants by techniques of artificial insemination which were, to the say the least, highly developed. In fact, how some of these mutant pregnancies were contracted is unknown to modern science. Immaculate or at least viral conception was pandemic and may have given rise to legends of demon lovers, the succubi and incubi of medieval folklore. Dr. Pearson continues, the virus, acting directly on neural centers, brought about sexual frenzies that facilitated its communication, just as rabid dogs are driven to spread the virus of rabies by biting. Various forms of sexual sacrifice were practiced, sexual hangings and strangulations, and drugs that caused death in erotic convulsions. Death during intercourse was a frequent occurrence and was considered an especially favorable circumstance for conveying the viral alterations. We are speaking of more or less virgin genetic material of high quality. At this time, the newly conceived white race was fighting for its biological continuity, so the virus served a most useful purpose. However, I question the wisdom of introducing virus 23 into contemporary America and Europe. Even though it might quiet the silent majority, who are admittedly becoming awkward, we must consider the biologic consequences of exposing genetic material already damaged beyond repair to such an agent, leaving a wake of unimaginably unfavorable mutations all ravenously perpetrating their kind. There have been other proposals. I cite the work of Dr. Unruh von Steinplatz on radioactive virus strains. Working with such established viruses as rabies, hepatitis, and smallpox, he exposed generations of virus to atomic radiation to produce airborne strains of unbelievable virulence capable of wiping out whole populations within days. However, this blueprint contains a flaw: the disposal problem posed by billions of radioactive corpses unfit even for fertilizer. Ladies and gentlemen, I propose to remove the temporal limits, shifting our experimental theater into past time in order to circumvent the whole tedious problem of overpopulation. You may well ask if we can be certain of containing the virus in past time. The answer is, we do not have sufficient data to speak with certainty. We propose, the virus may dispose. A thin man in his early 30s with sandy hair and pale blue eyes had been taking notes while Dr. Pearson was speaking. He looked up and spoke in a clear, rather high-pitched voice with a faint trace of Germanic accent. Dr. Pearson, I have a few questions. Certainly, said Pearson with cold displeasure. He knew exactly who this man was, and wished that he had not been invited to attend the meeting. This was John Alistair Peterson, born in Denmark, now working on a secret government project in England. He was a virologist and mathematician who had devised a computer to process qualitative data. Peterson leaned back in his chair, one ankle crossed over his knee. He extracted a joint from his shirt pocket. It was a loud Carnaby Street shirt. Pearson thought it vulgar. Peterson lit the joint and blew smoke towards the ceiling, seemingly oblivious of disapproving looks from the board members. He glanced down at his notes. My first question is a matter of a nomenclature. Pearson was annoyed to realize that Peterson was mimicking his own academic tones. Professor Steinplatz's experiments, as you must know, consisted of inoculating animals with various viruses and then exposing the animals to radiation. This exposure produced virus mutations tending towards increased virulence and he took a long drag and blew smoke across his notes. A increased communication potential. In plain English, the mutated viruses were much more infectious. I would say that is a more or less accurate paraphrase of what I have just said. Not precisely. The mutated virus strains were produced by radiation, and the test animals, having been exposed to radiation, were of course radioactive to a point but not dangerously so. The viruses were produced by radiation, but it does not necessarily follow that the viruses were themselves radioactive. Is not your use of the term radioactive virus and your evocation of billions of radioactive corpses misleading? Dr. Pearson found it difficult to conceal his annoyance. I have pointed out that, owing to the grave dangers inherent in large-scale experimentation which could among other things severely damage our public image, our data is incomplete. Ah yes, to be sure. And now if you will bear with me, Doctor, I have some additional questions. You have said that virus B23 resulted from radiation? Asked Peterson. I did. In what way does it differ from the strains developed by Dr. Steinplatz? I thought I made that point quite clear. The form of radiation emanating from the red light is unknown at the present time. You are then ignorant of the nature of this wondrous radiation, or as to how it could be produced in the laboratory? Yes. Has it occurred to you that it might be similar to Reichsdor, or deadly argon radiation, which is produced by placing radioactive material in an organic container lined with iron? Preposterous. Reich was a charlatan. A lunatic. Perhaps, but such a simple and inexpensive experiment, we could start with herpes simplex. I fail to see that any useful purpose. Pearson glanced around the table. Stony faces looked back at him. He was concealing something and they knew it. Dr. Pearson looked at his watch. I'm afraid I must cut this short. I have a plane to catch. Peterson held up his hand. I'm not quite finished, Doctor. I am sure that a slight delay in takeoff could be arranged for a person of your importance. Now, the virus strains developed by Dr. Steinplatz were, to be sure, more contagious and more virulent than the mother strains from which they were derived, but still quite recognizable. For example, the good doctor's airborne rabies would still be clinically recognizable as rabies. Even if the viruses were mixed into a cocktail, the individual ingredients would still be comparatively easy to identify. You would agree, Dr. Pearson? In theory, yes. However, we do not know, in the absence of large-scale exposure, whether the virus might not undergo further mutations that rend identification difficult. To be sure. The point I am making is simply that Dr. Steinplatz started his experiments with certain known viruses. Dr. Pearson, you have stated that virus B23 resulted from unknown radiation. Do you imply that this virus was so produced out of thin air? Let me put it this way, what virus or viruses known to unknown mutated as a result of this radiation? At the risk of repeating myself, I will say again that both the radiation and the virus or viruses are unknown at this time, said Pearson archly. The symptoms of a virus are the attempts of the body to deal with a virus attack. By their symptoms you shall know them, and even a totally unknown virus would yield considerable data by its symptoms. On the other hand, if a virus produces no symptoms, then we have no way of knowing that it exists, no way of knowing that it is a virus. So the virus in question may have been latent, or it may have been living in benign symbiosis with the host. That is, of course, possible, admitted Pearson. Now let us consider the symptoms of virus B23, fever, rash, a characteristic odor, sexual frenzies, obsession with sex and death. Is this so totally strange and alien? I don't follow you. I will make myself clearer. We know that a consuming passion can produce physical symptoms, fever, loss of appetite, even allergic reactions, and few conditions are more obsessional and potentially self-destructive than love. Are not the symptoms of virus B23 simply the symptoms of what we are pleased to call love? Eve, we are told, was made from Adam's rib, so a hepatitis virus was once a healthy liver cell. If you will excuse me, ladies, Nothing personal, we are all tainted with viral origins. The whole quality of human consciousness, as expressed in male and female, is basically a virus mechanism. I suggest that this virus, known as the other half, turned malignant as a result of the radiation to which the cities of the Red Night were exposed. You lost me there.
Did I indeed?
And I would suggest further that any attempts to contain virus B23 will turn out to be ineffectual because we carry this virus with us, said Peterson.
Really, doctor, aren't you letting fantasy run away with you?
After all, other viruses have been brought under control. Why should this virus be an exception?
Because it is the human virus.
After many thousands of years of more or less benign coexistence, it is now once again on the verge of malignant mutation, what Dr. Steinplatz calls a virgin soil epidemic. This could result from the radiation already released in atomic testing.
What's your point, doctor?
Pearson snapped.
My point is very simple. The whole human position is no longer tenable.
And one last consideration, as you know, a vast crater in what is now Siberia is thought to have resulted from a meteor. It is further theorized that this meteor brought with it the radiation in question. Others have surmised that it may not have been a meteor but a black hole, a hole in the fabric of reality, through which the inhabitants of these ancient cities traveled in time to a final impasse.
The rescue.
A sepia etching on screen. Written at the bottom in gold lettering, the hanging of Captain Strobe the Gentleman Pirate. Panama City, May 13, 1702. In the center of the square in front of a courthouse, Captain Strobe stands on a gallows platform with a noose around his neck. He is a slender, handsome youth of 25 in 18th century costume, his blonde hair tied in a knot at the back of his head. He looks disdainfully down at the crowd. A line of soldiers stands in front of the gallows. The etching slowly comes alive, giving off a damp heat, a smell of weeds and mud flats and sewage. Vultures roost on the old courthouse of flaking yellow stucco. The gypsy hangman, thin, effeminate looking, with greasy crinkled hair and glistening eyes, stands by the gallows with a twisted smirk on his face. The crowd is silent, mouths open, waiting. At a signal from an officer, a soldier steps forward with an axe and knocks the support from under the platform. Strobe falls and hangs there, his feet a few inches above the limestone paving, which is cracked here and there, weeds and vines growing through.
5 minutes pass in silence.
Vultures wheel overhead. On Strobe's face is a strange smile. A yellow-green aura surrounds his body. The silence is shattered by an explosion. Chunks of masonry rain down on the square. The blast swings Strobe's body in a long arc, his feet brushing the weeds. The soldiers rush off stage, leaving only 6 men to guard the gallows. The crowd surges forward, pulling out knives, cutlasses, and pistols. The soldiers are disarmed. A lithe boy who looks like a Malay shows white teeth and bright red gums as he throws a knife. The knife catches the hangman in the throat just above the collarbone. He falls squawking and spitting blood like a stricken bird. Captain Strobe is cut down and borne to a waiting carriage. The carriage careens into a side street. Inside the cart, the boy loosens the noose and presses air in and out of Strobe's lungs. Strobe opens his eyes and writhes in agony from the pric clings and shootings as his circulation returns. The boy gives him a vial of black liquid.
Drink this, Captain.
In a few minutes the laudanum takes effect and Strobe is able to walk as they leave the cart. The boy leads the way along a jungle path to a fishing boat moored at a pier on the outskirts of the city. 2 younger boys are in the boat. The boat is cast off and the sail set. Captain Strobe collapses on a pallet in the cabin. The boy helps him undress and covers him with a cotton blanket. Strobe lay back with closed eyes. He had not slept since his capture 3 days ago. The opium and movement of the boat spread a pleasant languor through his body. Pictures drifted in front of his eyes. A vast ruined stone building with square marble columns in a green underwater light, a luminous green haze, thicker and darker at ground level, shading up to light greens and yellows,
deep blue canals and red brick buildings, sunlight on water, a boy standing on a beach naked with dusky rose genitals, red night sky over a desert city, clusters of violet light raining down on sandstone steps and bursting with a musky smell of ozone, strange words in his throat, a taste of blood and metal, a white ship sailing across a gleaming empty sky dusted with stars. Singing fish in a ruined garden, a strange pistol in his hand that shoots blue sparks. Beautiful diseased faces in red light, all looking at something he cannot see. He awoke with a throbbing erection and a sore throat, his brain curiously blank and factual. He accepted his rescue as he had been prepared to accept his death. He knew exactly where he was, some 40 miles south of Panama City. He could see the low outline of mangrove swamps laced with inlets, the shark fins, the stagnant seawater. Harbor Point. Early morning mist, bird calls, howler monkeys like wind in the trees. 50 armed partisans are moving north over Panama jungle trails. Unshaven faces at once alert and drawn with fatigue, and a rapid gait that is almost a jog indicate a long forced march without sleep. The rising sun picks out their faces. Noah Blake, 20, a tall red-haired youth with brown eyes, his face dusted with freckles. Bert Hansen, a Swede with light blue eyes. Clinch Todd, a powerful youth with long arms and something sleepy and quiescent in his brown eyes flecked with points of light. Paco, a Portuguese with Indian and Negro blood. Sean Brady, black Irish with curly hair and a quick wide smile. Young Noah Blake is screwing the pen onto a flintlock pistol, testing the spring, oiling the barrel and stock. He holds the pistol up to his father, who examines it critically. Finally he nods. Aye, son, that can go with the Blake mark on it. Old Lady Norton stuck her head in the shop and said I shouldn't be working on the Lord's Day. And she shouldn't be sniffing her long snot-dripping nose into my shop on the Lord's Day or any other. The Nortons have never bought so much as a halfpenny measure of nails off me. His father looks around the shop, his fingers hooked in his wide belt. Lean and red-haired, he has the face of a mechanic, detached, factual, a face that minds its own business and expects others to do the same. We'll be moving to the city, son, where nobody cares if you go to church or not. Chicago, father. No, son, Boston. On the sea. We have relations there. Father and son put on coats and gloves. They lock the shop and step out into the muted streets of the little snowbound village on Lake Michigan. As they walk through the snow, villagers pass. Some of the greetings are quick and cold with averted faces. Is it all right if my friends come to dinner, father? They'll be bringing fish and bread. All right with me, son. But they aren't well seen here, there's talk in the village, son. Bad talk about all of you. If it wasn't for Bert Hansen's father being a shipowner and one of the richest men in town, there'd be more than talk. Quicker we move the better. Could the others come too? Well, son, I could use some more hands in the shop. No limit to how many guns we can sell in a seaport like Boston, and I'm thinking maybe Mr. Hansen would pay to get his son out of here. Spring morning, doves call from the woods. Noah Blake and his father, Bert Hansen, Clinch Todd, Paco, and Sean Brady board a boat with their luggage stacked on deck. The villagers watch from the pier. Mrs. Norton sniffs and says in her penetrating voice, "Good riddance to the lot of them." She glances sideways at her husband. "I share the same views," he says hastily. Boston, 2 years later. Mr. Blake has prospered. He works now on contracts from ship owners, and his guns are standard issue. He has remarried. His wife is a quiet, refined girl from New York. Her family are well-to-do importers and merchants with political connections. Mr. Blake plans to open a New York branch, and there is talk of Army and Navy contracts. Noah Blake is studying navigation. He wants to be a ship's captain, and all five of the boys want to ship out. "Wait till you find the right ship," Mr. Blake tells them. One winter day, Noah is walking on the waterfront with Bert, Clinch, Sean and Paco. They notice a ship called the Great White. Rather small but very clean and trim. A man leans over the rail. He has a beefy red smiling face and cold blue eyes. "You boys looking for a ship?" "Maybe," says Noah.